Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of the tensions that runs through my own thinking and manifests itself in the show and how we approach matters of science, poetry, mysticism, consciousness, is the question of what the heck is matter? I mean, you know, you stub your toe on a rock, it's pretty clear, some kind of physical object there. And yet the more you think about it, the more tricky the concept of matter is. You know, after all, if we look towards science to define exactly what a material object is, we find the strange paradox that often the information it gives us is increasingly abstract, you know, in the traditional way of thinking about material objects. Scientists, physicists will talk about primary and secondary qualities. Primary qualities being the most essential aspects of these material objects, where they're located in space-time, how we might identify them on a Cartesian grid, and most of the things that we actually associate with material objects, like what does it feel like, what color is it, what does it smell like all these things that are the most embodied, quote-unquote, physical aspects of the experience are somewhat dismissed in this traditional view as a mere secondary quality. It really has to do actually with our own nervous systems, not really with the object in question. So even if you use science, the sort of, you know, technology of understanding physical reality to locate where material objects are, it gets strangely kind of poetic. And then here on the other side, you have this sort of immense history of mysticism and religion and metaphysics and philosophy, which in so many different ways is trying to point to that which evades, escapes, transcends, resists, undermines mere material reality with some kind of soul, some spark, some higher dimension, some glowing heavenly shard that manages to make itself into this world. And I have a lot of trouble with that sort of dualism, that spirit matter breakdown, as do a lot of people who try to think about matter in a more than merely scientific way. You know, the many philosophers these days are talking about new materialisms, way to understand and embrace the totality of our material condition as embodied animals on a planet spinning in space, but not to stay limited by the kind of reductive thinking that's associated with a lot of so-called materialist people in terms of their scientific or even political points of view. So it's a sort of livelier form of materialism, even a kind of mystical form of materialism. I'm very attracted to those ideas, even as people are kind of coming again and again to see some of the fundamental faults and flaws in a merely materialistic view of the world. So I remain very I haven't signed up to my side yet. I'm open. I'm curious. I'm questioning this mixture of spirit and matter that we seem to find ourselves within. And I do know that there is one sort of zone of traditional esoteric thinking, of mystical or hermetic currents in the West that really plays with this tension better than anything else. And that, of course, is alchemy. And it's such a complicated subject. Alchemical texts are so confusing. They work on so many different levels. And even if you read contemporary accounts of alchemy that are attempting to be clear and historical or metaphysical about it, even these are often contradictory and somewhat confusing, even to the basic question of were alchemists, like, let's say, traditionally, you know, from the, you know, late Middle Ages, early Renaissance period, when we have a lot of alchemical texts and a lot of manuscripts and diagrams from that period, although, of course, the practice itself stretches back to the ancient world. But were these guys primarily motivated by, in a kind of proto-chemistry way, with the transformation of material substances, physical materials, perhaps into gold or silver, but really focused on the matter itself? Or were they actually really psychotherapists in advance who were using the language of material transformation as a kind of allegory for these internal spiritual psychological processes, which is how Carl Jung came to understand and reframe alchemy in the 20th century in a way that really impacted a lot of people's practice, spiritual, poetic, artistic, and really was sort of the dominant way that we thought about alchemy in the kind of modern world until more recently scientists and particularly historians of science have come around and said, you know, guys, sorry, that Jung stuff is interesting and all, but if you really go back and look at the text, these guys are talking about actually doing things with matter. And of course, the reality is somewhere, you know, in between or inclusive of both these domains. But it just is, goes to show that it's worth returning to alchemy constantly to renegotiate and re-experience the ways in which matter and spirit can be fused, pull against one another, transform our sense of history, transform our sense of what artistic or poetic creation is about, and remains very much a lively and practical, operational way of approaching the mysteries beyond merely reading about them or thinking about them. And so to dive more fully into the alchemical matrix today, we're going to talk to an actual alchemist. I met Brian Cote-Noir earlier this year, and had a wonderful time with him, and I've seen him give presentations earlier than that, so this time we really got to hang out. And I really like the fact that if you go online, he's written books, of course, you know, that's easy to say. He's an artist, and he's also an award-winning filmmaker, and he wrote a book, The Wiser, Concise Guide to Alchemy. But he's not just a historian of alchemist or writer about alchemist. He is an alchemist. And what exactly that means, we'll talk to Brian about. So with no further ado, Brian, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric. it's a very interesting lead-in. let's talk.
Sure. You know, one thing, actually, when I was thinking about it, looking at your bio, I was curious whether when you know, there's always the sort of like who you are, the text at the on the flap of the book,
and that you
choose to say an alchemist and not simply a historian of alchemists or a writer, that you're just going to grab the term, which means many things to many people. So I guess one place to start is when you know choose to bring that into your orbit to say I'm an alchemist. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for you?
Well, it means several things. One is it is an art, and in the history of things, it was known as the art. And I guess at the heart of all of this, what alchemy says, and what one of the fundamental texts of alchemy says, the Emerald Tablet, is that creation, all creative acts are fundamentally the same, and that. And through these things, they can be used as a material meditation in a way. I mean, this is how early alchemy was used. It was both a material and an inner practice, both at the same time. So when I say alchemist or identify with that, it embraces that, but it also points to the fact that I do experimentation. I have done experimentation, and I continue to do experimentation. Let me clarify that a little, and what I do, how I do, and what my aim is. And I think this will give a better, a much clearer idea. My whole interest in alchemy is based on the idea that it is a meditation. It's like a walking meditation, maybe even like a martial art in a sense, where you're embodying physical practice with inner meditative practices. So I've always had this interest with it. As you pointed out, it seems to be there. And in the history of alchemy, depending upon the alchemist and the time period, one side of it or another is emphasized, either a more material sense or a more spiritual sense. And sometimes within the same writer, you'll find them almost explicitly writing materially, but at the same time hinting and a suggesting of an inner thing. So that's my sort of primary interest in it. And so what I've done over probably more time than I'd like to think is that I'll start with a text, work through it, get a sense of what the material protocol is, attempt to replicate it. If I can replicate it, I'll replicate it. And then on the basis of the results, go back and reread the text, refining. The results of this thing will sometimes suggest meanings that are hinted at symbolically within the text. If anybody's ever read an alchemical text, you'll have an idea of what I mean. It's hard to, without getting into cases, explain more fully than that. So that's what I do. And then at the same time, there's, depending on the time period, my interest primarily now is within the Greco-Roman alchemy and Islamic alchemy, because for me, it's a point where both the inner and the outer aspects were practiced at the same time. Yeah, I mean, we see evidence with that in the texts. So that's essentially what I do, and I've done this over many, many, many years.
Talking about these many years, can you still talk a little bit about when you first got into this, just because it's always an interesting move? You know, a lot of us read a lot of texts. Maybe we have our own, you know, meditations, or we allow our imaginations to sort of respond to the things we read. But it's another thing to then say, okay, I'm going to go get some of this material and see what happens when I put it in a vial or whatever. So what was that change for you? And, you know, what was it about what was going on at that point that led you to actually begin
to do jump into it? Right. It actually started quite early. It was in grammar school, after my classes were over, there was like a local library on my way home from school. I'd stop, do my homework, and then just go up and down the stacks and just finding curious books, you know. And I found this one, and I think it was probably by the author Reed. It was like a history of alchemy or something. And I'd pick it up, I'd read a little bit of it, and it would annoy me. It just really irritated me, and I couldn't put my finger on why. And eventually I just started reading more of it. It just kind of hooked me that way. And it kind of blended, and I think most of us at that age, you know, 13, 14 or so, if we are kind of scientifically have a bent towards the sciences or the arts or just kind of curious about the material world, here was something that was kind of stepping in between. It had a kind of an approach to the material world, but yet there was this beautiful symbolism, imagery, surrealist, dreamlike quality to it that just really resonated with me. At the same time, it annoyed me, and I think it was part of that, my scientific leanings kind of going, oh, yeah, show me kind of a thing. And that was it. I just was sort of hooked on it. I went to Weiser's. I worked and lived in the city and, you know, just started frequenting there, started working there, and, you know, started acquiring books on alchemy, and then just started diving into doing some experimentation. And that's kind of how it kind of started.
How do you distinguish when you're doing work? Because I've had the great opportunity to visit your library and your workspace and to see some of the work that you're doing, and you know the kind of care that you bring to, let's say, your other art. I mean, you do editing professionally, but you've also done some works that are very artistic in that zone. There's a highly aesthetic quality to your particular alchemical experiments. And I've seen other alchemist labs, and they're not always so aesthetic. They're sometimes a little more, you know, bubble, toil and trouble with, you know, weird vats of green substances and things. And you can talk about
it. Well, that's in the other room that you
did the images.
That's in the other room that you didn't see.
But I guess the question is, how much is there a difference between getting down and dirty with the substances and then transforming those into kind of aesthetic objects?
The aesthetic object for me, I mean, they are aesthetic, and thank you. I appreciate that. But in a way, they're residue. I mean, there are traces. I use the visual medium. I use various artistic mediums as the focal point of a meditation, for instance. So, say if or when, like I am, I'm working on a question, a certain turning point in an alchemical text. What does it mean? There's a pointing to a substance. Is this pointing to a thing? Usually there's a series of images that are associated with it, either through myth, through the alchemical tradition, or even your own resonances. And in my research and work with particularly the early alchemy, you find this idea of, like, working with dream and image, right? And since I do work with these materials, I mean, I create things as I am trying to solve the problem or work on the problem. So I may have a laboratory experiment actually going and at the same time be working on images, drawings, word pattern type things that may lead to an insight into the process. It's actually, this is the process, and it's actually interesting. Salvador Dali rediscovered this and called it the paranoid critical method. Because this is essentially what they would refer to as the way of the philosophers, Stephanos of Alexandria. The idea was that you would open up all channels, right? Approach a question from all directions. And then, once all those things were there, step back and then try to synthesize it into this sort of luminous whole, right? And this is what Dali was saying in terms of artwork. You just kind of put it all out, you then reevaluate it critically, you then shape and form, and there's this dialogue. And this is what the original alchemy was. It was like working with these materials, a projection, but it was also a reflection of what was going on within. And you would bring it through these stages. The first matter, the black matter, was decomposed. It was then purified, whitened, turned red, and then eventually into this purple substance that could affect change. And what this represented were the changes and the ascent of the soul. And replicated and reflected, and it was a material process. There's a thing in an early text, and it's Zosimos, who's an early Greek alchemist, speaking to his alchemical partner, Theosobia. And this is another thing. They often worked in partnerships. And there's a point where she's asking, why are all these things hidden? Why are these things kind of like, you know, spoken of in code? And he says, because if what we did was really known, it could be just looked at as like glassmaking, right? And what that implies is that they are actually doing a physical process. But if people understood what the process was and didn't see what the inner working was, it would just look like any other material thing, any other craft. Right? In this case, he compares it to glassmaking.
Right. Do you have a sense of when do you think, since it seems like these physical processes, you know, emerged at a certain time in history out of metallurgy, out of the desire to, say, take a relatively common piece of metal and gild it in a way that gave it the impression that it was, you know, to play with it, not necessarily to fool people, but just to, you know, enhance its beauty and to start to play with these surfaces and depths and transformations. It comes out of the material practice for largely material needs. Where do you believe it started to take on, or indeed always had perhaps, but where did it start to take on this inner life? Or was it always there in metallurgy?
I have a feeling, I mean, in what I've never really pressed back that far, you know, but in my overall general readings and studies, it seems to, and probably one of the better writers on this is Eliade, and he wrote a book, Forge in the Crucible, which deals with, and he's suggesting that this is coming out of like a deep craft tradition of sort of like metallurgy as you know, well, being a sacred knowledge or a special knowledge and only accessible through the craft initiations and things like this. And I think there's an element to that. But there's also, I think it's just, you know, I think sometimes we've lost the direct relationship with the material world in interacting with it. You know, and if anyone's ever kind of melted metal or worked with metal or extracted metal out of ore, there really is something really quite remarkable when you see what looks like a rock all of a sudden over, you know, over processes give up this unbelievable substance called metal, whether it's, you know, copper, iron, what have you. Very different than the original material. So there is this idea of, you know, through our actions, we can change the world, but at the same time, I think I have no proof of this except my own experience, that you feel that there's something special going on there. There is a human quality that we bring to it or project onto it. So I think it was there from the beginning. And then is it accessed? Is it made more conscious? I mean, I think humans will take anything, right, and find a way to make their way into the inner meanings of it. I mean, we can either have a cup of tea or we could turn it into a tea ceremony. You know, we can either, you know, kick ass or, I don't know, some form of meditative martial art.
Exactly.
So I think it's like that. And then over time, it just depends upon what mind is engaged with it and what hooks them. You know, because as you were saying, in more like Middle Ages, Renaissance, were they focused just on the questions of matter? And the answer is yes, for some of them. And then for some of them, it was a metaphor for the spirit, you know, the whole spiritual work, usually within kind of a Christian mystical language. So it's the thing is, alchemy is not a monolithic system. You know, it's like 2,500 years, wide range of geography, and a wide range of people engaged in it. So it really becomes a question of who you are looking at and what were they involved with, because you find the range.
Yeah, one of the things that you've put out into the world is an extremely beautiful edition of the famous Emerald Tablet, which is probably the most famous root text of alchemy and very important for the whole Hermetic tradition. And that seems to also partly speak to your interest in the Greco-Roman period and that whole sort of framework. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that text and why you chose to retranslate it or create your own translation and commentary, but really kind of bring it forward again. It's almost like that's so, it's so common and it's so relatively short and sort of relatively clear. It's not completely gnarled with confusing, elusive elements, that it's almost, you can almost kind of take it for granted, like, oh yeah, as above, so below, you know, the Emerald Tablet thing.
Right.
And you really kind of brought focus on it through this beautiful book you put out.
Thank you.
And your work on it. So I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. It was exactly that. It was what you had said, that it's a very commonly quoted text. It's a very commonly known text. And it has such a simplicity and a directness to it that we think we know it. It's that sort of a thing. Because it was one of the earliest texts that was translated into Latin from the Arabic. And this is an area I've been very interested in as well as I was making my moves back into the past. Are these transition points between cultures? So the first one is sort of between Greek and Islamic, and then the other one is the Islamic transmission into the West. So there is a handful of pairings of Latin texts and Arabic texts. And so I was interested in comparing. And one of the earliest ones was the Emerald Tablet that was translated in the early 12th century from Arabic. And we have both of these texts exist. The earliest Arabic edition or version is from about 800 AD or so. and then the Latin is the translation from that. So over time, I studied Latin and studied Arabic and to translate this as well as other things. And so that's what I did. And it became like this extraordinary close reading, because I'm not fluent in Arabic, I'm not fluent in Latin, you know, studied for a few years to be able to do this. So it became this exercise of a very intense, a very close reading. And one of the things that came out was we're all familiar with one version of the Emerald Tablet that has it as above, you know, so below, so above. What the Arabic, and actually the Latin as well, that's translated from the Arabic, says is that the above is from the below, and that the below is from the above. And these are some of the things in the language that are actually rather specific. And if you actually take time to go through and go almost word by word for it, it starts to open up and reveal things. Now, what it's saying is really it's just a lot of Hermetic Neoplatonic philosophy and ideas kind of distilled down. But it's a much more radical understanding of what the Emerald Tablet is saying. Instead of this is a simile, like this is like that and this is like this, it's actually saying that they come from each other, that the universe is, in a sense, in constant generation and regeneration.
That was very powerful for me when I first saw you present on this, and then got the text later and you know read through it and read through your commentary, precisely because of that issue that I had been talking about at the start of the show about a kind of new materialism, a more animated materialism, a way of not pulling the transcendentalist move. You know, traditionally you look back at the history of Gnosticism and Hermeticism, and over and over again, there's like, you know, the flesh is putrid. Let's get out of here.
That's a fact. I mean, that's a Gnostic fact. I mean, you know, there's a lot in alchemy that talks about the entrapped and tortured spirit. You know, that's got to be released. You know, and it goes through these stages and it emanates. But there is a deeper. And after doing this, I've gone back and started to reread a lot of the early Neoplatonists, some of the theurgists like Iamblichus and things like this. And I don't know, I mean, maybe it is a projection into it, but all of a sudden you start to see it in a slightly different light, if you know what I mean. Instead of something emanating from something, it all comes down to the apophatic theology, the negation of something.
Yeah.
And it seems that, I don't know how to put it, it's like there's a whole lot of nothing at the bottom of it, and that it is a sense of things arising out of relationship with each other. And you start to see this, at least I start to see this after doing the work on this material, in the Neoplatonic and Hermetic traditions. And you even start to understand the Gnostic entrapment and matter a little bit differently, as opposed to, I don't know, like a much more literal sense of it, which is how oftentimes a lot of it is presented and understood. And on the surface, it's how it presents its own self, I think.
How would you characterize that somewhat different take on the classic, you know, Gnostic account of sparks of light trapped in matter?
Well, I think it's, I don't know, sort of us lost in our own noise, if you know what I mean. In a sort of a metaphorical way, you know? And then that noise, our own bullshit, gets reified into this idea of a thing, and then we call it, you know, it's holding me back. It's like, I don't know. These are things I'm just like you, kind of, you know, exploring, trying to understand. I don't know if that's a good answer or not.
It's the answer, you know. One of the things I was thinking about that's so interesting here, and then I learned a lot more in visiting you and talking to you about the objects in your room and the books and the sort of processes, was, you know, how much, in a way, to do alchemy now, to say I'm an alchemist, I'm doing alchemy, I'm not just writing about it or thinking about it or reflecting on it or making poems about it, like I'm doing it. It is partly a deeply interior process.
Yes, it is.
And I'm wondering, like, since you also communicate, you write books, you mm-hmm. give lectures, you're not just sitting, as some alchemists do, and I've met some, who just, they're off on their own. They're doing this. They maybe communicate with other people who are doing that kind of work, but otherwise, they're actually not really interested in communicating with the larger world. I'm curious how you navigate that tension between things that are esoteric because they're just so singular to you and your experiences versus a sense that you're participating in a more collective body of knowledge or way of being that can really communicate through texts, through objects that you share in the world, through poems.
Right. Well, this is actually the whole deeper aspect of alchemy. The word talisman, right? And this is a key word that comes up. And as a matter of fact, it's in the Emerald Tablet, and it's one of the hints that it comes from the Arabic version, comes from a Greek version, because in the Arabic it's a talismat, which is not an Arabic word, but is an Arabization of the Greek word for something that creates a result or is a result, and is a term in theurgy, which is sort of like magical practices for the elevation of the soul to union with God, that focuses on more material practices that act as a purifying of the soul. And these are often referred to as talistic practices. One of these are the making of indeed, talismans. And that doesn't necessarily mean, well, it does. It means everything you might think it mean and more, but let me get specific. The idea is that you'd be, and this is why it's an alchemical product as well, because what you are doing is you are transforming matter. You're taking something that is, and you're changing into something that it wasn't, into something more better, right? I mean, this is the definition of alchemy. It's bringing something to its final perfection or completion. And you think about that perfection and completion as you would a work of art. Right. Anybody who works an art piece will know there's a certain point where you know it's complete, it's done. So it's in this sense, you bring something to its final completion. Then when it is truly perfected in terms of a talistic practice, in terms of an alchemical practice, it in turn can turn around and have an impact on the world, right? This is the idea of the powders of projection that can change lead into gold. You would take ordinary matter, you can perfect it, alchemically speaking, you can perfect it into gold, stop there, and it can't do anything else except be its own gold. You can continue on the process and bring it to its final, absolute, perfect perfection, which in turn has reached perfection, so it itself can perfect, as they say. And this is known as a powder of projection. But it's also like what any kind of, I mean, artwork can do, any kind of creative work can do, can turn around and have an impact on the world. It's also kind of the concept of a bodhisattva, in a sense, right? They reach enlightenment but turn around to come back or not go and to have an impact upon the world.
That's a wonderful, I mean, because it's so easy, and people use alchemy as sort of a general metaphor a lot, you know, just mm-hmm. like talking about art as an alchemy or this or an alchemical transformation, just to refer to any number of things. But really paying attention to that, the difference between perfecting something in itself, which you mm-hmm. could think of as either, you know, sitting on the meditation pillow until you really reach something within that is like has a kind of stability or a clarity that's right. remarkable. And then that next step of continuing that process beyond the boundaries of that single practice such right. that it sort of turns around or it flips in a way back into the world, back into relation, back into the world of communication, the world of bodies encountering one another. And that shift is a really, seems like a really important key thing that the alchemy provides a really powerful metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I also think it's, well, here's the thing. It's also part of the scientific aspect of what I do too, in a sense, of like then, all right, here's what I saw, you know? So let me put it out there. Anybody else notice this? If you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it. And there's also, I have to say, and this has been my experience over the years where I've done talks, and I don't really, I mean, I don't, if someone asks me, I go, if you know what I mean. It's not something I do. It's like I enjoy them, they're fine, but it's not something I necessarily seek out. But I've noticed, it's like in these talks, there's a lot of artists. And it seems like there is something within the atmosphere, something going on, where it's almost like folks are tired of the academy. They're having these insights through their own work that no one else is really sort of talking about. If you're talking about any kind of artistic theory or criticism, it all tends to be of the academy, as I call it. All well and good, nothing wrong with that, but it's as far as it goes. And I think this is like part of the Occult Humanities Conference where we met is picking up on this as well. But I've noticed that, and I feel that within alchemy, approached properly, there's some useful insights and tools. And that's actually what I'm hoping. I'm actually finishing up another book, Alchemy, the Poetry of Matter. This has been something I've been working on for a very long time that is kind of grappling with all these things, as well as some practical experimentation and how this inner and the outer link up. You know.
Can you give an example of some of the practical approaches that you outline in the book?
Practical approaches in what way?
Well, just like the experimental aspects.
It's how to make the purple powder of projection. I give it all away. No, I'm just kidding you. What I focus on in it are several things. One is as way of an example, this idea of the way of the philosophers. So there is this compound or this concept called the green lion, which is a key element and a key compound in alchemy. So what I do with this is, as an example, show how one would approach the way of the philosophers, the way one kind of churn up a lot of meanings through this, and then start to resolve into something that you can actually then start to experiment with. So there's that. With the Emerald Tablet, I mean, I did the edition you saw and have, and then that's actually a reduction and a beautified version of a much larger chapter in the book, focusing on the Emerald Tablet. And what I do is I parallel that with a four-stage process in Greco-Roman alchemy, and to kind of illustrate this linkage between inner and outer. And I think this might be helpful. It's an analogy I often use of the stereogram, an image that, you know, if you can cross your eyes and it pops into 3D, sort of a thing, right, or a stereo viewer. And the idea is you can read an alchemical text, right? And most people say, oh, yes, I can understand this being a material and spiritual thing, right? You say, okay, fine. And like a stereogram, you can look at this left image and say, yes, that's the material aspect. And it's all pointing, it's almost using the same language to the same thing. You look over to the right side, right image, and you say, well, that's the spiritual aspect. And again, you can see it's the same image. It seems to be pointing to the same thing, but it's a little slightly different, but the same. So what happens is the whole thing, a whole idea of this is to unify the two. And like the stereogram, it's like when you unify them, they pop into this thing that you would never experience, right, with just one or the other. Right? You following me on this?
Yeah.
And it pops into 3D, and there's information there. There are things there that you would see that you could not have seen in either one or the other. And this is a type of thing when that kind of union of inner and outer happen, you get an insight into something, right? It's that aha moment, but it depends upon the particularities of it. It's that sense of that aha when something pops together, or when you've been struggling to create a 3D image, to have that fuse so that you can see it, and when you're struggling, all of a sudden it happens. There are these moments.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of what I was sort of pointing towards at the beginning of the show by being very open and affirming about the way in which I remain unresolved about whether it's useful to think of the world as a place of two different substances, spirit and matter, or rather something that's either, you know, purely mind or purely some kind of material process, that it's precisely by having different views that you keep, that you kind of oscillate between or sort of force against one another, that you do get these perspectives, these moments,
right,
whether it's in thought, whether it's in your, you know, day-to-day life, whether it's in just a conversation. You know, often conversations can be places to have these stereogram effects.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And, you know, and you talked to even earlier about how a lot of the classic alchemical texts seem to also be about conversation, about more than one person sharing information, sharing their own kinds of experiences.
Right. And that's actually what one of the earliest, we can't say it's the earliest, it's this, the only text that's surviving. It's the earliest surviving Latin translation. And it's a dialogue between a Christian monk and a Islamic prince. And it's, the prince is seeking, you know, a teaching on how to do the great work and stuff. And really, it's when you understand the inner meanings of it, it's almost as if it is like a remove all the religion away from it. It's like a younger, you know, seeker, you know, finding an older adept, and that the language that they use is the language of alchemy to cross the borders of their own, you know, religion, culture, what have you. And that's also kind of an intriguing way to take a look at this material as well. But this idea of the union of the two views, in a sense, like right eye, left eye, seeing with two eyes is how it's sometimes referred to, I think I think it's key. What it all means, you know.
But, you mentioned before about the way...
Yeah, can I just say something? I would like to give one little example.
Absolutely.
Right? Like as an insight, the above coming from the below and the below coming from the above. And it was happening simultaneously. I was doing some experimentation on actually setting up some simple distillation and circulation equipment, right? Very, very basic. Actually, I have another small book out called On the Quintessence, which deals with basically a quintessence of wine. And there's a... And I was experimenting with different apparatus. And one you can make out of a martini glass. You cut the bottom off. Anyway, it's a very simple circulation device. And I had it set up experimenting with it. It had pure alcohol in the bottom, and the top and the condenser portion was ice. And it was just this little chamber of that you could see through, right? And as the alcohol was evaporating, it was condensing. And what was really cool was, as I was watching it, these little tiny clouds started to form around the condenser head, and then it started to rain, like these little tiny drops of alcohol. And I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, at first I just saw this mist coming down, and I thought, where's that coming from? Oh, it's coming from above. And it was like, where's that? That's coming from below. And as simple as that was, right, I was working on the translation at the time, it became very apparent that in addition to this idea of the creation of the universe, they're also talking about a very simple circulation device, which then points to the experimentation and the laboratory aspect that they were talking about. But what this was also was a very simple verification of that observation that the above comes from the below, which is what it was doing, right? The alcohol is evaporating, condensing, and that little misty rain that was coming was, and you have this whole circulation, and this is what the Emerald Tablet is pointing to, and this is what it's saying all creation is like. There's an out and an in, back and forth, up, down, sort of a thing.
That's a wonderful example, and also points to something else I wanted to ask you about. Earlier you had mentioned how, you know, you are also a scientific type. You were interested in science from a young person. Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of technical operations. You understand how to think about things as a scientist. And I'm curious how you think about that part of your work or the work, in the sense that, you know, a lot of people who, you know, think about science today or identify with being a scientist today would look at a lot of the stuff you're talking about and be like, whoa, man, that's just way too wiggy. Like, that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, that's absolutely
and you're saying,
right.
Well, actually, there are ways in which this is also knowledge that is shared and that we have,
right.
You know, we can share things. So I'd love to hear you how you experience and conceive that part of your practice in terms of science.
Okay. Well, for one, I did my undergraduate degree in chemistry and physics. I did alchemy, and then I realized I stayed out of school for a couple of years after high school to do my own reading, do some of my own research and work, and realized, you know what, I want to study chemistry and physics. So I went, did my undergraduate degree, and then continued on to film. So I have, you know, proper laboratory training, proper, you know, scientific approach to things. And I always felt that was really needed and necessary in this work. There's a saying that came out of the 17th century, per ignium, by fire. And that the idea is that if this is real, if this is happening, it could withstand the test. In other words, gold won't be destroyed. I mean, my patron saint, if I had one, would be St. Thomas. It's like, oh, yeah, show me. You know, let me stick my fingers in there. And without that attitude approaching alchemy, you're in a hall of mirrors. You're into, like, self-reflecting on a lot of wishful thinking, right? And then before you know it, it's just this fantasy world of, well, I say so, so it is, and this is not what it's about. So, and this idea of the union of these two things, of an inner and an outer, in order to have it really happen, both sides, if you want to consider sides, need to be fully developed, right? So, going back to that stereogram, if you have one side of that is a very nice, sharp, clear, crisp, decent contrast and on one, and the other one is kind of crappy, sort of not very much contrast, lit out of focus, you try to join those two together, it's not going to happen, right? The other one will overwhelm and the other one will just blur. But if you have the two equal, you can't have unity without the developed, you know, you can't fly without two wings kind of a thing. So that's part of the idea of it.
Do you have a circle of like really tight researchers that you've been working with for a long time, or do you find it more kind of comes and goes depending on context, the sort of, you know, groups of other people, because there are, you know, there's hundreds, thousands, perhaps, people who are really seriously dedicated, whether they're doing spagyrics with plant matters or whether they're working more with metals. But, you know, they're around. I've met them. It's fascinating to talk to people like this. But is there a world there where you're constantly kind of keeping up with one another, or do you kind of go off into your cave and come up with something and then go, hey, guys, what's up with this?
Yeah, I'm kind of solitary, for no other reason than that's just my own natural kind of inclinations towards things. It more resembles kind of artistic work in the sense of what I put out, if you understand what I mean in terms of a process. It's
sure.
Not so much that it's, I don't know. I just do what I do, and when it goes out, it goes out, and I interact with people as they come forward, and maybe we might do some work together, maybe we won't. But I'm not really tied into or hooked up with or too much of a thing here in New York City. There are folks I do know of. We do run into each other from time to time, and, you know, I think we're more apt to talk about other things, not so much out of a secrecy. I think everybody is very willing to talk about stuff, but it's also just a way to get out of your own head sometimes, if you understand what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, since we did talk about you talked about film a little bit, and yeah. You know, as you said, editing is in part your day job, but it's also has been something that has been, you know, deeply aesthetic for you as well. And I'd love mm-hmm. to hear a little bit about, since you worked in another kind of medium that is not explicitly alchemical in any way, what kind of feedback is there between these worlds, even with particularly the particular art of editing film, which is a very specific kind of work of juxtaposition? And
exactly. That is exactly it. It's alchemy. It's composition. I mean, actually, when you actually get back to alchemy, this is one of the first early Greek terms for it, chrysopoiesis, gold composition. Poiesis is also the term used for alchemy. So it's this idea of poetry of composition. So yes, any kind of art, but I think especially film. It moves through time. You have several layers that occur simultaneously. Music is like this too, but it doesn't have the visual element to it. So I guess maybe in another realm, opera would be another alchemical art. And it's the idea that you have a visual track, you have audio, and you have, let's call it text, whatever meaning that comes across through words, right? Any one of these you can play as a single strand, like a melody. And so you could watch the visual element go by, and it can tell a story, its own story. You can listen to only the audio tracks, right, without word, without image, and that itself can tell a story, create moods, and suggest things. And then you can just listen to the text. The challenge is weaving those three together, and a musical analogy would be sort of chords start to arise, how they start to speak and play with each other. And then how does that unfold over time? And the real alchemy comes in between the juxtaposition of image, because meaning arises there. And this is where it gets very alchemical, when you ask yourself, where does that meaning reside? And you start taking that apart, and you are actually engaged in an alchemical process of taking something material, asking what makes it what it is, and then opening it up, and which is the...
You there? Oh, shoot. Well, we lost... sounds like we lost Brian there, so we'll try to get him back in just a second. To let you know, I think the film that he is best known for... is called The Inland Sea, and I think it's a little tough to get a hold of. I have not seen it yet, but it's about Japan, and it won a lot of awards. And it's like more like an essay film than a narrative film. Hopefully we'll get the man back on before. Okay, getting him. Sorry, guys. Oh, we got a busy signal, so we're just going to have to hang out here a little bit more. We'll talk more also about his edition of the Emerald Tablet. It was a big splurge for me. I like good books, but I don't usually spend that much money on them. But I couldn't say no. It's got this beautiful Islamic surface on the text, and then it unfolds in the accordion fashion. And it's really quite a remarkable expression in physical form, as well as a really interesting take on the text. And the other book that he's known for is this Wiser Book of Alchemy, a concise guide to alchemy that also includes a lot of experiments in it, which I have to say that I've been too lazy to do myself. I seem to find myself unable to actually do some of these practices that are so fascinate me, but that's what you get when you're a Gemini being, you know, hopping around between multiple frameworks of mind. So I encourage folks to go and check out his other products there. And I'll put a site up that. Are you back there?
Yeah, I'm back. I'm back. It seems like the Illuminati Illuminati cut us off.
Bastards. I know. Well, it was good actually, because I took the time to plug your books.
Oh, why, thank you. Thank you.
So yeah, we just have a couple of minutes left. So maybe could you what's up with the Poetry of Matter? Is that coming out soon? You're gonna
Actually, I'm very happy to say I am getting pages back. I'm expecting the last 20-30 pages back from my proofreader for the first initial round. I'm really hoping to have this sucker done by the end, like my portion of it done by the end of the summer. So maybe by next spring I could have it out. I'm not sure, but this is what I'm aiming for.
Are you putting it out yourself?
Well, this is what I'm, it's an alchemical book. It's a talisman type thing. It's this thing. So how it's laid out, I'm working with a, she doesn't know this yet, so I can't really fully say it, but, the woman who did the typesetting and layout for the Emerald Tablet, I'm trying to seduce back onto this project, into this project. So we'll see how that works out. So yes, I would do it as a small edition first, because I just want to make it the way it needs to be made. Because I also, it's part of a book art thing and kind of obsession on my part. But then after that, I would then try to find a larger publisher for it and get it out. So I'm hoping to have it both in my beautiful form and then whatever form the publisher needs to put it into.
Well, I mean, increasingly that's the way to do it in the esoteric book market. We've seen so many beautiful, so much wonderful book art in the last, decade plus. I mean, it's, of course it's been there continuously, but there really is a sort of evolved world now of people doing multiple editions, some incredible fine art editions, and then really nice, more affordable ones too for that kind of world. I mean, it's in the face of our digital revolution. It does seem that particularly in esoterica, the value of the physical book remains very powerful and very poetic.
Right. And also very functional. I have to say, there's a thing about memory and where you locate information that a book allows you to kind of almost have it as like a three-dimensional, four-dimensional space. I know when I read something and study something, it's almost like I can picture where it is dimensionally in the book. I can't do that digitally. I find digital information extraordinarily linear. And like looking through a straw. If you know exactly what you're looking for, you could do the word search. But if you're looking for that word and you're only looking for that word, you're bypassing many other words that might trigger other ideas, if you get my meaning.
Totally. Brian, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric. It was great. We'll talk
all
soon.
Right. Brian Cote Noir, and look out for his books. I'll put his website up on the PRN site. It's at Khepri Press, khepripress.com. And so until next week, keep your minds open.